Welcome back. It's a Monday, the 29th day of April, 2024. I'm your host, Mark Gall. On this Monday morning, as I begin to look at what's going on around the nation and the world, looks like the propaganda cycle, at least what passes for news, has shifted. Gone are the references to World War III, at least for now, the Ukraine front or the Middle East front. We're still hearing about the next booga booga flu, and you know that one's going to come real soon now. But interestingly, the big story seems to be, at least among the alternative press, more bank failures. Who could have possibly imagined such a thing? And Zero Hedge tells us, well, we certainly did, and they're right. Anyway, regulators seized, says the Wall Street Journal, the troubled Philadelphia bank, Republic First Bank Corp, and sold it to its fellow regional leader, Fulton Financial, the fourth high-profile bank failure since last spring. Almost certainly, folks, there'll be more to come. March will be lit. They said back when we had reverse repo ending, BTFP expiring, Fed cuts, at least allegedly, and don't expect that to happen, even though the Biden fewer probably needs it if they're even going to pretend that he might win this next election. And quantitative tightening, allegedly, has ended too. So admittedly, says Zero Hedge, we were off by a couple of weeks, but trouble has been brewing in the banking sector, and Friday evening after the close, we did get the first bank failure of this year. And the FDIC estimated this particular failure would cost the deposit insurance fund around two-thirds of $1 billion. Hardly even worth warming up the printing presses for anymore. The Wall Street Journal says First Republic has been struggling for months to stay afloat. And the only question remaining, as Zero Hedge puts it, is, hey, who's next? And while the multitude of reasons should be obvious, Zero Hedge points out, you shouldn't be surprised given that rates are now higher than they were at the start of the Silicon Valley bank crisis, which means that unless banks hedged hard or managed to dump their bonds at a loss, they're even more underwater than they were. U.S. Bank, says Bar Chart, finished the year with almost $400 billion of unrealized losses on assets held to maturity. The assumption is this wouldn't be a problem because the Fed would come to the rescue and cut interest rates a whole lot this year. But doesn't look like this is going to happen. And even with the Biden fear in trouble, what if they don't? Add to this the fact that last week, seasonally adjusted for tax season, U.S. banks saw the largest deposit outflows since 9/11. And since, as they pointed out up front, the Fed's BTFP bailout fund has now been terminated and is slowly running down as the terms for the loans mature, the banking crisis seems to be back and breathing hard. And next, folks, another one of those stories from over the weekend that's so obvious that you'd figure all it takes is the headline. Revealed, says the Daily Mail, and that's kind of a major admission coming from them, George Soros is the head honcho communist paying activists to head campus protests that, of course, have wreaked havoc all across America with a K. Multiple leaders of the so-called anti-Israel protests at college campuses across the once-free United States have now been revealed to be paid fellows of Soros-connected groups. Three of the major figures in the pro-Palestine encampments in universities are fellows at the Soros-funded U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, reports the New York Post, and they're paid a whole lot of money for wreaking destruction. The organization instructs its fellows to, quote, rise up and spark revolution, while specifically telling them to reject anything that sounds like reform. And among those funded by the Soros Open Society Foundations over the last few years include UC Berkeley, NYU, University of Minnesota, Emerson, Columbia, WashU in St. Louis, University of Texas at Austin, Yale, Tufts, Harvard, MIT, University of Maryland, Vanderbilt, and UNC Chapel Hill, among others. And they have all kinds of wonderful, clever sayings that they're pushing too. And these sound oh so peaceful and anti-fascist, don't they? Things like obliterate Israel, Zionists don't deserve to live, and this particular favorite, quote, kill a Jew. And I guess, folks, if you can say that you see some parallels between this Fourth Reich and the Third, you're not alone. And I mentioned up front that at least U.S. coverage of the Ukrainian front of World War III seems to have slowed of late. There are still sources like Hal Turner's radio show that are reporting things like this. Russia attacked railway facilities in three different regions across Ukraine on Thursday night and into Friday morning as the country's defense minister vowed to step up strikes aimed at slowing the flow of what are claimed to be critically needed American weapons and equipment that America might need if they actually defended their own border, but hey, who cares, to the front. The latest attacks on the rail network came after Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu promised to target the new Western weapons as they arrived in Ukraine, saying, quote, we will increase the intensity of strikes on logistics centers and storage bases of Western weapons. After the U.S. announced shipments of ATACMS, or missiles, that would be used to hit deeper within Russia. No wonder they're upset. Missiles, by the way, that the Biden Fuhrer promised would never be sent there. Yeah, and who believes that blithering moron? They put something in front of him, he puts his X where they tell him, and then reads the teleprompter. By the way, here's another story that came out over the weekend indicating in just what a low regard the Biden-Fuhrer regime is held internationally. You may have heard that Biden campaign manager and so-called Secretary of State, what a joke himself, Tony Blinken, was in China basically convincing them that even their puppets aren't what they used to be. And after Blinken left, Xi Jinping was caught on a hot mic, and it seems, says the coverage, that the Chinese leader apparently just plain couldn't wait for the so-called Secretary of State to get the heck out of that communist regime. Asked Xi, when is he leaving? Said the aide, tonight. The response, good. Yet another regime that holds even the Biden regime in the low regard it so rightfully earned. Meanwhile, of course, who and the deep state Davos, Bill Gates, WEF New World Order crowd who pull their tyrannical strings is still trying to take over the world. And we're seeing more and more pre-plandemic hype that certainly makes it look like we're closer by the day. Here's just a sampling of the headlines from multiple sources and stories that indicate, oh yeah, they're really stoking the fires on this one. Like USA Today, bird flu outbreak is an evolving situation. Here's what you need to know about the symptoms and spread. Another one, what we know about bird flu and food safety today after it spreads to humans in America. How about this one? Experts sound the alarm over H5N1 bird flu and warn of a potential pandemic, say it with me folks, worse than COVID. You've heard the rest. The Guardian, bird flu detected among chickens in Texas and Michigan, found in South Dakota, dairy herd. Texas health officials issue warning. Bird flu now in 18 states, restrictions placed on cow movement. Bird flu is spreading to more and more farm animals. Are milk and eggs safe?
What do you mean, biblical?
What he means is Old Testament, Mr.
Yes.
Mayor. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Enough, I get the point.
On April 3rd, the Financial Times asked, the next pandemic, they didn't spell it right, is coming. Will we be ready? And just this weekend, the Daily Mail said, inside the world's deadliest cave that could cause the next pandemic.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
And remember, folks, how many times they had to try and kick things off before COVID finally caught the desired traction. Marburg, Ebola, Zika. Later, monkeypox, you name it, and we're not done yet. Matter of fact, they're just getting rolling. Right now, says a piece from Kit Knightley at Off Guardian, they're talking about Disease X, a term which caused just a little panic in certain sections when it first appeared on the scene, but it's part of a placeholder theme. And as a placeholder, the name does its job for the time being because they don't really need the actual name yet any more than they need the actual disease. The idea is just to hold it over people's heads while they construct the legislative nightmare of their coming health-based tyranny. Indeed, vagueness is what Disease X is all about. That's why it's helpful because it keeps the legislation equally vague. That said, though, they'll want and or need to produce an actual disease at some point. If it kills a lot of people, so much the better. When that time comes around, it'll probably be another respiratory disease because they're easy to fake using pre-existing endemic databases and their more or less uniform symptoms. And, yep, we've said it. I've talked about it here on this show, folks. The prime candidate is bird flu, H5N1, but there are other H's and N's around as well. And it's been slow-bowling in the news for 2 years now. They've killed tens of millions of chickens and other poultry, also helpfully putting a big dent in the food supply and raising costs. And now they got a big uptake in the coverage due to allegedly having it passed to people from cows. There are headlines like this, gleefully even from the Daily Star, new pandemic expected as human to human bird flu is of great concern to who? And yeah, let's not forget, bird flu is not only a convenient pick, but really logical, because it enables the tyrants to both push their health tyranny, the vaccine passports, lockdowns, masks, all the other idiocy that we've seen from before, and their food transition, you will eat bugs, at the very same time. Because they can claim that dairy, beef, chicken, and eggs have all become dangerous as an excuse to either ration them or just outright kill them and make sure that either way you don't get them. And of course, prices, if they're available at all, go through the Bidenflation roof. And then you know it, they're already pushing it, the idea that veganism, maybe lab-grown fake meat, prevents pandemics, which they've been claiming for at least 3 years or more now. Says the piece from Kit Knightley, the only real downside to the bird flu scam is that it's hard to work in the bogus climate change angle into the narrative, so maybe they'll have to go with something else on top of it. But you do know we're getting closer because earlier this month, the White Whorehouse published their new Plandemic Preparedness Targets. And the Federal Death Agency, hey, if you can't trust them, who can you trust? Maybe the FBI or the CDC. They posted a new update on their findings concerning the AH5 and AH7 viruses, confirming contamination in pasteurized milk. And here you thought it was only raw milk that was be afraid, be very afraid, booga booga dangerous. And how did they do it? With the polymerase chain reaction, or infamous PCR test. Well known for providing all the false positives any tyrant could want. They wrote the following last week, that the FDA received some initial results from their nationally representative commercial milk sampling study, and the agency continues to analyze this information. However, be aware that the initial results show about 1 in 5 of the retail samples tested with the PCR qualitative test for HPA1 viral fragments showed a greater proportion of positive results coming from milk in areas with infected herds. While they note, and you ought to take special care to note this, folks, PCR result positives don't necessarily represent actual virus that may actually be a risk to consumers, but it sure is scary. Additional testing is required, they say, to determine whether the intact pathogen is still present or if it remains infectious or if it was ever really a problem or existed to begin with, but we're not going to emphasize that part. The FDA is further assessing any positive findings through egg inoculation tests, which is the gold standard for determining if an infectious virus is really present, they say. And here's the admission. Early work by NIH-funded investigators, SICK, indicates an absence of the infectious virus in their studies of retail milk. So I guess that's something they're going to have to work on. Which leads to this next question, again courtesy of Kit Knightley's piece, how will what we're going to see next differ from COVID? Because any future pandemic psyop will be unlikely to follow the COVID pattern beat for beat. How stupid do they think people really are anyway? One thing, the COVID narrative spent itself out before it achieved everything it was meant to achieve and the massive death totals that they're still jonesing for. But you can bet the farm, says Knightley, that in the 4 years since they unwrapped this one, there have been working groups and researchers sick that have been poring over the pandemic data to see just how effective their tools and propaganda really were to figure out what went wrong and how they can fix it next time. Still, says the piece, there seem to be 3 major recurring themes. Like this one. People kind of got sick and tired of the lockdowns, and they saw through it eventually. So next time, there'll need to be a focus on securing vaccines for everybody, whether you like it or not, especially, rather than lockdowns. Indeed, suggests this author, and this is plausible, folks, part of the old, aw shucks, gee, lockdowns turned out to be more damaging than we would have thought, rigmarole, is about setting up the dynamic that next time we need to do anything we can, including mass vaccinations, whether you like it or not, to avoid those lockdowns. So now they've become a threat rather than a fact. In other words, next time we're going to mandate those vaccines, and your e-vaccine passport will prove it, because we and the economy can't afford another lockdown. Or how about this one? You have to have that vaccine, and you'd better know that it's going to be mandated because you don't want to have another lockdown, do you? So there'll be more testing, bogus as we know it was, more masks, more vaccine mandates, and more quarantine camps for the un- or under-vaccinated. And when they do have lockdowns, you know it'll be confined and blamed entirely on the anti-vaxxers. Number 2, speed, speed, speed. The main failing, they note, of the COVID narrative was that it ran out of steam. And by the time the vaccines rolled out in early 2021, the pandemic fatigue was already setting in. People were getting sick and tired of it. Some of us were already starting to see through it or more. And by the time the third round of boosters and the fourth waves then rolled out and were in the headlines, nobody really cared anymore. And those that did were either dead or some of the maze bright had started to figure it out. In other words, the propaganda blitzkrieg of early 2020 was perhaps the greatest and most wide-reaching misinformation campaign of all time, and it was certainly almost overwhelmingly effective, but it slowed, eventually stalled, stopped, and staled. So this time around, they know they're going to have to do one thing, and that's be blitzkrieg fast before people can figure out just exactly what hit them. And Bill Gates said as much at the 2022 Munich Security Conference. They need to get the next disease out, get the deaths up, and the vaccines in before people realize that this is deja vu all over again. And you know what? They're even now talking about the 100-day vaccine plan and challenge. That is, how to contain the virus and to keep it spreading and keep the fear level up while the so-called scientific response, you know that, it means the vaccine, as well as the diagnostics and treatment that go right hand in hand with it, can be approved, manufactured, and then force-fed to the public. Your host can't help but observe that it's a lot easier to make that time schedule if you somehow or other know in advance exactly which of the booga booga pathogen candidates you intend to release. The 100-day mission, says the piece, is the brainchild of the CEPI, Bill Gates, and the WHO-backed NGO, and its main aim is to make it possible to produce new vaccines for previously unknown, or at least...
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
In 100 days or less... Oh, yeah, and I guess this bears pointing out, although it's not obvious, folks, you're probably going to be duped. It should go without saying, say everybody that's been paying attention, that the concept of safe and effective vaccines cannot be produced in 100 months, much less 100 days. So whatever it is that they intend to make, sell, and force inject you with, it won't be a vaccine. But that shouldn't surprise anybody that's still alive, at least, by now, anyway. Finally, let's not forget this. Free speech is dangerous, certainly to those that want you dead. The slow development of the post-2020 narrative may have hindered the health tyranny agenda, says the author, but it was the independent media and those of us that saw through the BS right up front that really heard it. The impromptu network of dissident experts, independent actual researchers, and even socialist media movements ended up spreading what the ministries of truth called misinformation faster than the powers that be could fact-check, and extinguish it. We've seen perpetual messaging about the dangers of misinformation, malinformation, and disinformation ever since, including prominently at the most recent Davos summit earlier this year, where it was labeled one of the three greatest dangers facing the planet. And last week, a parliamentary committee in the UK published recommendations that were headlined this way, quote, government should learn lessons from the pandemic, and yep, they spelled it wrong, in order to approve, no, it says improve, communications and counter misinformation. And just last week, Gordon Brown was quoted in the news warning that fake news risks our carefully laid preparations for the next pandemic, which heavily implies, as if we didn't know this, that they're going to move to counter the fake news before they release their next pandemic. And by the way, folks, Kit Knightley seems to believe, and I don't necessarily agree at all, that they'll wait until after the next election before unleashing it. And why? He suggests they need it to be during flu season so they can co-opt normal seasonal deaths into their plandemic narrative. I can't help but remind him they've got a whole bunch of deaths already on tap as a result of the last plandemic. People that took the boosters destroyed their immune system, and they're still dying for all kinds of reasons. They got to roll those up somehow or other. And how better than to blame it on the next plandemic? And then he says, I think they'll also want to wait until after the big election year is over so they can have their fresh governments in place. Well, at least in the United States, one thing you can guarantee is whatever government ends up in there, it won't be fresh. I can't help but think, hey, look how effective the last pandemic was at rigging the election and making sure they could scare people away from voting on actual election day. Why, for crying out loud, would they change that when it worked so well? So color me skeptical about at least that aspect of it. And by the way, the more we see the booga booga H5N1 bird flu at all hype being ruled out, the more I tend to believe expect it sooner rather than later. Over the weekend, the deep state EPA came out with another regulation intended to destroy what's left of the U.S. power grid, a new mandate intended to shut down coal-fired electric power plants. So I thought this was apropos concerning EV mandates that won't have any power anyway from just exactly 1 year ago today. Concerning, and I quote, new regulations to force working class and low-income Americans, those who can't afford a real car, to purchase expensive electric vehicles instead that will add more pressure on the already overstressed U.S. electrical grid, which is fixing to go down anyway, folks. The latest step here in eliminating the U.S. middle class in America, brought to you by the Biden regime, it says, was of course cheered by none other than the New York Times, which wrote, the Biden administration, yeah sure, on Wednesday proposed the nation's most ambitious climate regulations to date, two plans designed to ensure that two-thirds of new passenger cars, wait a minute, two-thirds of zero, folks, ends up still being zero ultimately, and a quarter of all new heavy trucks sold in the United States are all electric by 2032. The new rules would require nothing short of a revolution, say the sycophants at the Times in the U.S. auto industry, a moment in some ways as significant as that June morning in 1896 when Henry Ford took his own horseless carriage for a test run and changed American life and industry forever. Well, what they're going to do is put an end to all of that. And here's what the damnable liars at the New York Times are never going to remind you about, and that is that Henry Ford's revolution was voluntary. He had something that the American people decided they really wanted, and it revolutionized society for the better because people went out and worked and bought it voluntarily. And if the current communist regime-like rules were in place then, there would never have been an American automobile industry to begin with. If the two rules from the U.S. EPA are enacted as proposed, they would put the world's largest economy on track to, get this, slash its planet warming emissions at the pace that bogus, whoring, bought and paid for scientists say is required of all nations in order to avert the most devastating impacts of climate change. What a bunch of horse pucky. If the new rules are enacted, or if they're simply allowed to go into effect by fiat, as is often the case, what they will do is exactly what they're intended to do. In the ability of most Americans to actually be able to go anywhere in a private vehicle ever again. And what they're intended to do, of course, is destroy the entire concept of the internal combustion engine, and at the same time, overload and then destroy the U.S. power grid. What they won't tell you, Jim Hoft goes on to note, is that the cars, while they're allowed to run at all, will still indirectly run on what? Oil, gas, and coal. Because the real energy source is still fossil fuels, and guess what? Without fossil fuels, there isn't an electric grid. There's not enough electricity to power the air conditioners, much less the cars. No amount of pixie dust magic, he says, for energy production will change that reality anytime soon. And the one real option, folks, like nuclear fusion, well, you're not hearing much about that now, are you? They go on to point to a chart provided by Alex Epstein on his Substack, which basically makes the visual point there is no physical, engineering, or realistic way whatsoever that the U.S. economy can ever have the number of vehicles running on electricity that it now has, or for that matter, even close. The claim is that the idiotic new EPA dictate will increase the market share of EVs in the vehicle market from 6% up to 67% by 2032. And remember, there's an easy way to do that. Just get rid of all the non-EVs, and voila, you're there. Which, honestly, folks, is pretty much what this does. So, clearly, the mandate will force Americans to drive far more expensive, less capable cars. Remember, you can't really use them in the winter anyway, and you won't have air conditioning if you want to drive very far in the summer either. And as any real economist will tell you, if they were any good, they wouldn't need the lavish subsidies or torpedoing of the competition. Bullet point number two, today's EVs, despite the promises that they would already surpass gasoline vehicles, are simply not even remotely cost-effective for the vast majority of Americans. That's why, despite huge government subsidies, only 6% of Americans have actually been duped into buying so-called electric vehicles. And they'll become even less cost-effective in the future due to the obvious problem of rising electricity prices and growing shortages that are occurring as reliable coal and gas-fired power plants are being shut down in favor of unreliable wind and solar, as well as increasing raw material prices due to artificial government-created demand for batteries. Recharge issues and range issues are, of course, a logistical nightmare, even if you could afford a home recharge station, and you'll never be able to do it off-grid, folks, at least not without your own Mr. Fusion. Which is why almost all EV owners have a real car that runs on gasoline or diesel for when their virtue signal on four wheels just won't cut it. Which means EVs would be ruinous for the poor and middle class who won't be able to afford that. Let's not kid ourselves, they're not going to be able to afford food. Currently, notes Alex Epstein, the fossil fuel part of the transportation sector consumes about one-fourth of all U.S. energy, meaning that in order to handle a huge influx of EVs, the already fragile electricity sector would have to rapidly add a whole lot of reliable electrical capacity, and that is precisely the opposite of what's being done. So, can't afford an EV? Don't worry. You wouldn't want one anyway. There won't be any power for them, and guess what? It's all part of a larger plan that hopefully you've figured out by now. Thanks, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.